The following live presentation by Rabbi Benny Friedman is brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To learn more about Israelite, please visit our website at www.israelite.org. Additional contact information is available at the end of this presentation. Thank you for learning with Israelite and enjoy the experience.
We're about to take a walk back in time. And I want to basically give you, by way of introduction, a little bit of food for thought on just what we're going to do and what this means, and maybe perk up your antennae a little bit. First of all, having said what I just said, now I can tell you that it's really not true. Because one of the mistakes that we make sometimes is this perception that history is about looking back at time. And I'm not so sure that that's the case. Okay? I remember one year I got stuck in the army for Seder. Right? It was the night of the Passover Seder, and there was nothing more depressing than being stuck in the army in general, particularly on Shabbat, and particularly on a festival. So this is the night of the Pesach Seder, and it was incredibly depressing when you found out that you were one of the guys stuck. But once you got used to the idea, you figured, all right, it'll be an experience. And they actually moved us to a bigger base for the Seder, so they wouldn't have to make all these little Seders like that night. And there must have been about 300 soldiers. And we're in this huge dining room in this military base, actually built by the Americans down in the desert. Can't tell you exactly where, because I'd have to kill you. And you have to understand that you're talking about a Seder with basically every cultural background that exists. I mean, you know, Moroccan Jews, Yemenites, Syrians, French, Jews of Polish and Lithuanian descent, an American, a couple of English guys. I mean, just everything you can imagine, right? You run a Seder like that, the rabbi has to really be on the ball, because he's got to be aware of everybody's different customs. Everybody wants to, you know, you're all depressed. You want to at least sing your song, right, when you get to your thing. And, you don't want to have a Seder last till 3 in the morning. Anyway, we get to a certain point in the Seder, and all of a sudden, it was a section of, it's called Halach Ma'anya, right, which is in Aramaic. This is the bread of our affliction, Tiachalu Avatana V'yara the Mitzrayim, that our forefathers ate in the land of Egypt. And all of a sudden, I noticed that these guys, like there's a few fellows around the room who are standing up. And they all seem to be doing something. I look over, I see one of them, right, and he's like taking his matzah, right, Halach Ma'anya, this is the bread of our affliction. He's putting his matzah in his napkin. And I thought, you know what, I grew up in a traditional home. You know, what you might label Orthodox, and been doing the Seder my whole life, never saw the napkin matzah deal, right? So I'm curious what's going on. And I noticed that the two guys that I could see are both doing exactly the same thing, and they're chanting this tune, Al-Hamanya, right? So, you know, it sounds like a very painful experience, you know, but that's the Yemenite tunes. And then they take this matzah, and they wrap it up in this napkin, they pull this knot down, they throw it over their shoulders, and they start dancing around the table. And I realized that what they were doing was they weren't remembering the Exodus from Egypt. They were re-experiencing it. You see, on Pesach night, we're supposed to remember the Exodus, right? V'zacharta et asher, and you shall remember that what's happened to you. But the Jewish conception of to remember is not a passive experience. For example, it says in the Ten Commandments, Zachor et Yom HaShabbat, remember Shabbat. How do you fulfill the mitzvah of remembering Shabbat? You would think that you fulfill the mitzvah by sitting down, closing your eyes and saying, but that's not what we do. We make kiddush. Right? You stand up, you give testimony to God's creation of the world and whatever else. You're actively participating in the experience. And that's what really remembering is about in Judaism. Because just to recall something has no value unless it affects who you are. Now I tell you this because you need to sort of have a sense of what we're about to do. I'm not a tour guide. I never wanted to be a tour guide. This was really a hobby for me. But you can't study in the old city of Jerusalem and not experience it, right? So if we're going to spend a week here, we got to go take a look at what it is. But really, all I'm interested in doing is to whet your appetite, wherever you are, right? Whatever you're doing, right? To explore this city, okay? I got involved in this quite by accident. We had a tour guide once that canceled 5 minutes before a tour, because we always had this philosophy that, you know, students should get a chance to go out and do a little touring. You can tell a group that's expecting a class that they'll get a tour. You can't tell a group that's expecting a tour that they're going to get a class, right? So 5 minutes before a tour, all of a sudden we didn't know what to do. So I figured, all right, I'll take them out and tell them some stories, and I had such a good time, and they had a good time, I guess, so I've been doing it ever since. The little bit that I know fills up, like, I don't know, 6 or 7 different tours, And that's like the tip of the iceberg of what there is to learn. We're going to walk 500 yards within the vicinity of where we are now. I mean, and we could spend a week, literally, walking around the old city of Jerusalem, just the little that I know, without running out of things to do. So if you enjoy this, which is why we really wanted to do this on the first day of the program, if you enjoy this, I hope this whets your appetite to explore on your own. I am going to try really hard not to take you anywhere that, you know, you could go to on your own. We're not going to go into the museums that you can pay 5 shekels and get the sound and light show, because you can do that on your own, but I'll point them out, right? And maybe one last word. I'm really not into, you know, the difference between the Crusader Arch and the Byzantine Arch and the structure of architecture and whether Suleiman the Magnificent built the walls in, you know, 1538 or 1555. Not that that isn't interesting to me personally. That isn't what grabs me when I get to walk around Yerushalayim with a group. What fascinates me are the stories. You know, I was once invited to a cultural studies department day, okay, at Carnegie Mellon University. And basically the idea was that, you know, students who were studying there and at Pitt would come and they would explore their cultural heritage. And the way that they were going to do this was they invited 4 individuals who had a background, you know, some particular cultural identity, and we were going to share who we were and, you know, our identity, and then they would ask questions and break up into groups and whatever. They were actually expecting 50 people to show up. They got about 300 students that came. They had to move it to a different hall because everybody's into, you know, who am I and where am I coming from, right? There were 4 of us who were invited. One was an African-American who had actually done a documentary into his roots. There was a Native American, right, an American Indian. There was a Palestinian, actually, who was passing through on a lecture tour. And then there was me. To this day, I'm not sure if I was the token Israeli or the token Jew, or both, right? Anyway, first guy gets up to speak, and he's the Native American, right, American Indian. And he gets up there, and, you know, stereotypes are a terrible thing. I mean, we do ourselves a disservice by buying into them. But if you could pick a stereotype of a Native American, of an American Indian, this guy would be it. He was like 6'2", bronze skin. He even braided his black hair just for the effect. He stands up in front of the audience. He says, you know, my name is Jim. I kid you not. And this guy could have been Tonto, you know. And he says, but my real name is, I don't know, Naga Hawe Noane, right? Which means he who runs with the river and spears elk in the morning, you know, or something like that. And he starts describing his heritage, you know. 300 years ago, his ancestors wandered the plains of the Midwest and learned to hunt fish with their spears in the river and to go out into the mountains for tests of manhood. And I'm a direct descendant of Chief Sitting Bull, and I had a relative at the Battle of the Little Bighorn. And he starts telling his whole story. I thought, wow, this is amazing. This is amazing. And I'm sitting up there on the dais, I'm thinking, I am so glad I agreed to do this, because I thought I'm doing them a favor. This is so great to meet someone like this and to get, and he was so charismatic, and we're getting into it. And I'm looking around the audience, and I started noticing that there are a few faces. I recognized, I was in Pittsburgh for the year, and I used to give a class, I used to call it my cheeseburger class, because it was a class at a temple sort of a little bit ways out of Pittsburgh. And they asked me to give a class on, you know, Jewish ritual and mitzvot and whatever. And one day I was giving a class on what being, you know, what kosher is, what kashrut is. And I always thought like a cheeseburger is like a safe example. Nobody gets offended by a cheeseburger. You know, you talk about intermarriage, so somebody might have a personal, but cheeseburgers. And while I'm giving this example, this one of these students is like eating a sandwich and then kind of looking at a sandwich. I realized he was eating a cheeseburger in the middle of class. So after that, I called them my cheeseburger class, right? So I see there's a few students from my cheeseburger class, and they're sitting in the audience. And I realize that they're as much on the edge of their chairs as I am. And that's when it really hit me. And then it was my turn. And I have to get up, and so I get up there, and I'm thinking, should I, shouldn't I, should I, shouldn't I? And I figured, all right, what the heck, right? So I stand up, I say, my name is Benny, but my real name is Binyamin ben Pinchas. And I am a direct descendant of Abraham, who begat Isaac, who begat, you know, you throw in a begat and you're in, right? Who begat Jacob. And my ancestors wandered the plains of ancient Mesopotamia, crossing over the Jordan River into Canaan land, right? And I see like all the Jews in the audience, they're all doing what you're doing. They got this smile on their face. Yeah, hey, Benny, way to go with the Abraham, all right. But it's true. I mean, we come from a 4,000-year-old heritage. And in those 4,000 years, right, people have come to this place, to Yerushalayim, to Jerusalem. They've walked its stones. They've explored its alleyways. They've left their mark, right? And you're not visitors to this place. you're a part of this ongoing experiment. And what really fascinates me are the stories. So I'm basically going to share with you a few places and a few stories, you know. And we'll see what we get out of it. It's very rare that I go, you know, that we do this, that we take a touring walk around, and I don't learn something new. So if you heard something different, you have a different perspective, feel free to share. What we're going to do now is we're going to go up on Israelite's roof, okay, and we'll take a look around, okay? So come follow me. All right, so you're standing on Israelite's roof, right? And I want to show you a little bit about what you're looking at, just to give you a sense of where we are. I want you to know what I love about this place the most. You know, it's the first day of a program, and, you know, you have a whole couple weeks in Yerushalayim. So this is like your space. Like, we're going to get into some very intense discussions, and you may discover that you need a little kind of, you know, time to think, right? So if we get into that mode, this is the place. The holiest place in the entire world is the top of that cupola right over there. I spent many hours with many students sitting up there, just letting go, relaxing, you know. So if one day, in between classes, just need to think a little bit, especially like late in the afternoon, come on up here, okay? Just a little bit about what you're seeing. So you look to your left, and you'll see in the distance, there are those new buildings over there, okay? Up on the hill, all the way in the distance. All right, first of all, in terms of directions, you're looking north this way, directly behind me, right, facing, you know, sort of the Gold Dome and the Kotel behind me, that's east, right? This way is south, and of course that way is west. The new part of the old city of Jerusalem, western Jerusalem, which was always part of Israel, even after 1948 and before 67, is that side when you get out of the old city. Everything behind me, including where we're standing and the whole old city, is part of East Jerusalem. So I'm going to try very hard this week not to get into politics, but when they talk about East Jerusalem in the news, for whatever the reason, give it away, give it back, keep it, love it, hate it, whatever it might be, they're talking about everything we're going to see now. That's part of East Jerusalem, okay? If you look up on the hill over there, you'll see the new neighborhood of Ramat Eshkol. See those new Israeli-looking buildings up there, okay? That did not exist before 1967. In 1967, there was a barren hill up there. Yerushalayim is called an Ir Harim Savivla. A city that's surrounded by hilltops, by mountaintops, okay? That is the mountain of Ramat Eshkol. Up there in the distance, you see there's a tower past the Gold Dome, and that's the tower of Mount Scopus, Har HaTzofim, Mount Scopus, okay? You can see the Augusta Victoria over there, right? That tower over there. You can see the Mount of Olives over here, right? And you can see to your right, due south, what's called Armon HaNatziv, the Palace of the High Commissioner. I'll get to that. Maybe we'll work back. So if you look at Ramat Eshkol, that neighborhood, that's an interesting story. There's a hill up there called Ammunition Hill. I cannot tell you enough what a valuable trip that would be. You can actually go out there on Friday. It's well worth the trip. There's a museum there, which I think personally is a powerful museum. There's a sound and light show you can see in English. The story basically of Ammunition Hill is a simple story. The Jordanians knew that that was a very important strategic position. Look how high that is, right? That commands an unbelievable view of Western Jerusalem. And the Jordanians actually shelled, the Jordanian legion shelled Western Jerusalem from that hilltop. So Israel wanted to try to take that hill. We failed in 48. In 67, when the Jordanians actually began to shell, this is an interesting story. In 1967, in May of 1967, Egypt and Syria massed enormous forces, thank you, very large forces on our borders, okay? Without going into the numbers of divisions, Israel basically had to call up all of her reserves. The entire Egyptian 8th Army was camped on the border. And remember that between 1948 and 1967, Israel was a lot smaller than it is today. So Israel had to call up her reserves. The radio waves were filled with the diatribe of, we're going to finally push Israel into the sea, we're going to wipe them out. After about a month of this, Israel didn't know what to do. I mean, we can't afford. You have to understand that the standing army of Israel is only about 15% of the actual army. The job of the standing army, which unfortunately has changed so much with the intifadas that we've experienced, etc., is really to hold the fort until the reserves can be called up. Israel cannot win wars without its reserves. So the reserves, which is 80%+ of the army, they're called in, and that's how that's exactly what happened in the Yom Kippur War, that's what happened in the Six-Day War. But Israel can't hold its reserves. The reserves are like, you know, 10% of the population of the country. can't keep the reserves in the reserves for endless amounts of time. The economy grinds to a halt. So eventually, after a month, without anybody willing to step in, Israel decided that it would have to strike the first blow. It was facing a war of destruction. I mean, our backs were against the wall. There was a secret telegram, and the rest, of course, of the Six-Day War is history. If anybody wants, by the way, if this tour opens up little bullets, kind of like, oh, I have a question about that, file them away, or maybe when you get home and you get this in an email, you can file it away, and I'm happy to have a discussion over lunch about any of this stuff, okay? Anyway, Israel sent Levi Eshkol, who was the president, the prime minister, sorry, of Israel, sent actually a secret telegram to then young prince, Crown Prince Hussein, begging him not to get involved in the war. Israel was facing a two-front war. Levi Eshkol already knew that there was going to be a war because he knew when they were going to do it, right? But he didn't want Jordan involved because having a third front in the middle of the country was a very difficult thing. But Jordan, for various reasons, notwithstanding pressures that they were receiving from Arab, you know, from the Arabs to create a greater Arab front, actually shelled Western Jerusalem. They had 6-inch guns posted up on top of that hill and that hill. At which point Israel decided that they had to take that those hills. You know, you can't tolerate artillery landing on your civilians. So once they decided they were going to take those hills, they realized there's a natural reches, a natural line of hilltops. They would end up having to take all these hills, at which point they realized they could take the old city of Jerusalem. And that's really how that started. If Jordan had not shelled New Jerusalem, we would not be standing here right now. This would still be Jordan. And there are so many educational messages in there. Chaval Azman. We can talk about that another time. But in any event, that was the first hill they had to take. Now, the problem was that the Jordanians had fortified that heavily. When the Israelis got up to take that hill, it actually was a mission that started about 10 o'clock at night. The tanks got stuck in a minefield. The infantry had to proceed on their own. And Ammunition Hill was basically fortified bunkers. Bunker warfare, trench warfare, is one of the more difficult types of warfare. There's a system for fighting trench warfare, right? It's basically a leapfrog system. You have like a narrow trench, and you know, you're moving forward and covering the line, and there's what's called kuchim, little sort of cubby holes, as they were, little caves off the main trenches, and that's where the soldiers or the defensive positions are, and they come out, and whoever shoots first wins. And you know, you move a little and fire, and then the other one moves, and you leapfrog and cover each other, right? So that if anybody runs out of ammunition, there's somebody firing. Jordanians are very clever. They developed a trench system that was so narrow that only one individual at a time could barely squeeze through. So now you've got, you know, a company of men, they're all behind you, you're moving through the trenches, and you run out of ammo. Well, what do you do? Who's going to cover you? And it wasn't like they knew this in advance. So on the spot, the officer who was in front just threw himself down, screamed out, Alai, you know, on me, and they just ran over him. You know, it sounds like a scary thing to do, but if you're in the middle of a trench warfare and they're firing you, that's the least of your problems. And this was a new system of warfare that had never been developed before, and that's how they took Ammunition Hill. Okay? Moving to your right, you'll see in the distance Haratzofim, Mount Scopus. There's a hospital up there, Hadassah Hospital, the Mount Scopus campus. Hebrew University is up there, one of its campuses. And I always thought that was such a beautiful name, Mount Scopus, to scope, litzpot, right? The scouts are called Sofim in Israel, right? To scout out. I thought, what a beautiful modern name, until I was reading Josephus. We're going to actually talk about Josephus next week when we go to Masada. Josephus was basically a Jewish quasi-historian who was also a rebel general, who left us an exact account of the period of time of the destruction of the Second Temple, which is an incredible read. I have a copy in my office if anyone wants to take a look at it. And he mentions Mount Scopus, Haratzofim, you know, almost 2,000 years ago. On that mountain, okay, if you were sitting on a rooftop just like this in the old city, 2,000 years ago in the year 67 CE, Common Era, on a winter's day in December, maybe a clear day just like this, you would have seen a cloud on the horizon. And it would probably have taken you a couple days to realize this was no ordinary cloud, because it more or less hung in the same spot and just kept getting bigger. My guess is by the third day you would probably have figured out this was no cloud at all. It was a dust cloud, made of the dust raised by the feet of 10,000 marching Roman legionaries. Titus brought his generals up on that hilltop, Haratzofim, to scout out Jerusalem and plan his siege. He was a brilliant tactician. He understood the psychology of warfare. And Josephus describes the first day of the siege of Jerusalem in the year 67, which is really the beginning of the end. He brings his troops, 10,000 men, a massive army, up over the hills, on this entire rechas, on the entire hilltops. He marches them in a straight line down, banners waving, you know, Roman precision. When they get to the point, just at the end of the eye level of the Jews, as if people in the city might not be able to see them anymore, they break into two perfect Roman columns and they begin to surround the city. And if you were a Jew sitting on a rooftop like this 2,000 years ago, it was probably on that afternoon that you finally realized that it was no longer a question of whether, it was just a question of when. It's amazing to sit here 2,000 years later and be able to look at Mount Scopus, Har HaTzofim, and to realize that, you know, it's the seat of a university now, right? If you work your way, I'm just going to give you the whole panorama and then keep your questions, right? If you look a little closer, obviously, this mountain here with the famous gold dome, this is what we call the Temple Mount, Har HaBayit, okay? Those of you who end up taking the Kotel Tunnel tour, which I highly recommend, you will discover that that gold dome is the exact spot where the Beit HaMikdash, the Jewish temple, stood. It was built 2,500 years ago, the second temple. The first one was built 3,000 years ago. In fact, they had a big celebration, the 3,000th anniversary of when David built Jerusalem, right? And that gold dome actually sits on top of a very important rock. It's called the foundation rock in Judaism. The Kabbalah believe, you know, the Kabbalistic idea is that from that rock God formed the world. It's called the Evan Shetiyah or Evan Yetzirah, right? The Muslims believe that that rock was the rock which Burak, which was the horse of Muhammad, he was on some mystical journey out in the desert, and he took a magic leap, and it landed here, and its footprint imprinted on the rock before it leaped up to heaven, right? So, no political commentary necessary, right? What's interesting to note, however, is that is not a mosque. The Gold Dome is not a mosque, okay? They don't pray in there, right? So, why isn't that the mosque, if that's the holy site? Because that's the mosque. You see that gray dome? Now, why is the mosque over there on the southern tip of the Temple Mount instead of over there where the Gold Dome is on the northern tip? It's very simple. It's because the holy cities of Islam are Mecca and Medina. And just like we face praying Jerusalem, you know, anywhere you are in the world, you face Israel when you pray. And if you're in Israel, you face Jerusalem. And if you're in Jerusalem, you face the Old City. And if you're in the Old City, you face the Temple Mount. And if you're standing right by the Temple Mount, you face the Gold Dome, because that's where the Beit HaMikdash was. In fact, it's interesting, when you go down to the Israelite Beit HaMikdash, take a look at the floor tiles, you'll notice that they're a very strange angle. And that's because the angle is exactly designed to face towards the Beit HaMikdash, so that when you're praying, you can just align yourself up, you know exactly which direction to face. You know, when we have our service Friday night, you'll see what I mean. But in any event, so this southern tip of the Temple Mount actually faces Mecca and Medina. And I always find it interesting that the Muslims on the Temple Mount have their back to the temple, you know, to the place where the Jews are actually praying towards. So I once had a student who had a great idea. He said, what's the problem? He said, imagine you're all in the middle of the Temple Mount. So the Arabs are facing this way, the Jews are facing that way. Let's just split it up. It's one of those ideas that just sounds so smart until you put an Arab and a Jew together and try to work it out. Then it kind of falls apart. But it's an interesting idea. I will tell you, by the way, one interesting thing, just as a piece of food for thought, you know. We very often open up these tours to anybody who wants to join us, especially the old city tours, and we do it also sometimes in the summer for the neighborhood, so that, you know, it's like a service to people and tourists and community, and you know, we didn't used to when we were doing that type of program. We didn't charge money. We just wanted people to come and see. So sometimes I do a tour, I get like 150 people, didn't really know who was there. So I remember one day we're sitting up here with like 100 people, we're up on the roof, and I'm talking about the old city, and somebody raises his hand, and I didn't know who he was, so. So he says, let me ask you a question. Are you like a religious person? So we got into a discussion, what is religion, and how do you define religious, and the word religious doesn't really exist in Jewish source work, and it's a label, but okay. So I said, look, if you want to know if I grew up with Jewish tradition, kosher, Shabbat, yeah. So do you pray three times a day? I said, yeah. So he said, well, so then three times a day you're praying for the temple to be rebuilt. I said, yeah, that's another interesting question. What and why? So he says, so that means that three times a day you're praying for the holy places of the Muslims to be destroyed. That's a horrible thing. So it's like total silence on the roof, right? So I said, you know, that's a really good question. I said, you know what our problem is? Our problem is that we think too small. See, it's no big deal, you know, to ask God for a miracle, that God should come and destroy the, I don't know, the Golden Dome or the mosque or whatever, we should build our temple. We could have done that in 1967. I mean, we weren't ready to build our temple, and thank God we also weren't ready to destroy their mosque, and I'm okay with that. That's a small miracle.
If you're going to dream, dream big. See, my dream is that one day a billion Muslims wake up and say, oh my gosh, we got to build a temple with the Jews. That's the way to go. If a billion Muslims decide to build the Beit HaMikdash, then I'm sure the world will be okay with it. But we're not there yet, but we're working on it one day at a time. Anyway, you can see in the foreground, right, obviously the Kotel, the Western Wall. You know, when you have a really crowded day at the Kotel, but you want to go to the Kotel, you can just come up on a roof. You know, next best thing to being there. You can see from here very clearly how the Kotel is the supporting wall. Excuse me. Thank you. I'll do anything to get a bracha. Is the supporting wall for the whole Temple Mount. In fact, every once in a while somebody always asks, well, you know, I mean, the Arabs were here in 1948 to 67, and for hundreds of years before that, and they didn't exactly treat Jewish sites with great respect, you know, hopefully that'll change. Why didn't they destroy the Kotel? It's a very good question. That's because God has a great sense of humor. You see, that's the supporting wall for the Temple Mount. If they take down that wall, that golden dome and that mosque come sliding down with it. It's almost as though Hashem wants us to be dependent on each other, which I love, right? Maybe just a couple more things, and then we're going to head out into the world. You can see in the distance the Mount of Olives, Har HaZeitim. Okay? You see all those little things there. Those are actually graves. That is the oldest continuously used Jewish cemetery in the world. Now, it's an interesting question. Why is that such a special place to be buried? I mean, what made people want to be buried there? So I'll tell you an interesting thing. After the Hadrianic... Yes?
This one here, or the one
in the distance,
right?
In the distance.
Straight ahead.
Straight ahead, right? You see where there's a car going, there's a road,
yeah.
Right?
Pardon? So people still get buried there?
Yeah, absolutely. It's expensive plots.
Here, all the way up?
This whole area up there. That's the Mount of Olives. You can see, by the way, on an interesting piece of history. By the way, you can see Jordan very clearly in the distance. You see that? That's Jordan. Jordan is those mountains in the distance there. Right there, that's Jordan. That's how small this country is. If you went up on the roof of Yeshivat HaKotel, okay, and you look due west, you could easily see the Mediterranean Sea. You can see both borders of Israel. That's how small our country is. You know, this kind of like from sea to shining sea in America, it sounds great. In Israel, it's a much more practical issue, you know. It takes an Air Force jet 90 seconds to traverse the entire country. Okay, so blink and you're gone, right? It's a whole other discussion. But in any event, in fact, one of the challenging things about the Mount of Olives was that in 1948, you know, this entire area fell to the Jordanian Legion. They were an excellent fighting force. We'll talk about them in a little while. And in that process, right, so the Jordanian Legion itself actually escorted the Jews who were under siege in the Old City out of the Old City. And the Arabs, who could not, thank God, take their vengeance out against Jewish lives, took it out against, instead, Jewish property. And one of the unfortunate victims of that violence was the cemetery, right, Har HaZeitim. Give you maybe a couple of examples. There's a hotel on top of the hill called the Seven Arches Hotel. There are many Jews who will not stay in that hotel. I had heard stories about this, and I always thought it was a legend. So when I came here in 1981, I went to check it out. I went up there, went to the hotel, went downstairs. There was a men's room in the downstairs vestibule. And you could actually, back then, I've heard since that they've changed it for PC reasons, back then you could still see fragments of Jewish tombstones that were used to build the latrines. Okay, they built a Jordanian army camp in there, and that road, right, was built right over Jewish gravestones. In fact, there's a whole project now to reclaim and restore many of these graves. They're graves that are going back thousands of years. Period of the Mishnah, I mean, it's incredible stuff that you can see down there. If you want, by the way, maybe on Sunday, we'll have a little time at the end of the program. For those of you who want, I'll be happy to walk you out and take you for a closer look. During the day, it's perfectly safe. Happy to do that if you want. But in any event,
the inscriptions on the grave sites are really beautiful.
Some of them aren't, and some of them are. It depends on the gravestones. Depends
where. Pardon? Do some of the graves go to Temple Mount?
Yes, there is actually a grave down there attributed to Avshalom, who was the son of King David. There is a series of graves that belong to Kohanim from the period of the Mishnah. The Mishnah was the period of the Temple, same period of time, from about 300 before the Common Era until about 200 after the Common Era. Maybe just one last thing, which is interesting. So what made Har HaZeitim, the Mount of Olives, so special? Now, like its name, it used to be, the theory is, olive trees up on top of that mountain, which makes sense. This whole region, we're going to see this when we go to Gush Etzion. I think next Tuesday we're going to Gush Etzion. It is absolutely one of the most beautiful vistas in Israel that I'm going to take you to. And you'll see that the economy was totally based on olive trees and vineyards. So the olive oil from which they anointed kings came from that mountaintop. As a matter of fact, the Mishnah talks about that on the new moon, at the beginning of the month, it's very important that Jews everywhere would know what the new moon, when the new moon fell. Because, like, you have to fast on Yom Kippur, so you have to know when the new moon is, the first day of the month, so you know when the 10th is, etc., etc. So they would send messengers. But that became very difficult. So eventually what they did, they had a system of bonfires. And the Mishnah actually delineates some of the mountaintops where they lit these bonfires. And we've actually found archaeological evidence of this, right? And the mountaintops go all the way. In fact, we've identified one of them is called Sartaba. We're going to see that mountaintop very clearly when we go up the Jordan Valley to the Golan Heights next Wednesday, Thursday. Plug, 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 right? And then they crossed over the border, over what is today Jordan and Syria, into what is today Iraq, which was Bavel. And they ended up in the center of Bavel, where the majority of the Jewish community was in the time of the Talmud, right? And all the Jews would come out and light torches, and it was this big celebration, right? And it began here on this hilltop, right? They would declare the new moon in the temple, in the courtyard of the temple. Two witnesses would come, would say that they'd seen the sliver of moon, right? They would be quizzed and questioned, and when the Sanhedrin decided, when the high court decided this was indeed the new moon, they would send a flame in the temple, to which they would, and the people waiting up on top of this mountain would light the torch, and it was called Har HaMashcha. Har HaMashcha, the mountain of the anointing. Mashiachat Hashem and Mashiach, the anointed one, right? And so that was the Mount of Olives. Anyway, after the temple was destroyed, and after the Bar Kokhba rebellion, when millions of Jews were butchered, the Romans, and eventually the Roman Empire became the Roman Catholic Church, right, forbade Jews to come into the Old City. A Jew caught inside the Old City was put to death except for one day a year. Anybody want to guess which day? Nope. No, they wouldn't want us in here on Yom Kippur because that's a holy day. You know, we're getting a lot out of that. Tisha B'Av. They were quite happy with our coming into the temple to cry and weep over the temple because that was a demonstration of the fact that we were suffering because we didn't accept their Lord and whatever else it might be. And by the way, just so we're clear here, because this topic may come up again and again, nobody should think, God forbid, that this is a judgment on Christianity today. It's an absolute judgment on Christian, or at least Catholic history. I don't consider myself an expert on Catholicism. I have enough trouble trying to learn about, you know, and be an expert on Judaism. But I think it's an interesting question. But in any event, I mention this because the Jews used to come up to Jerusalem three times a year. And they would celebrate the festivals. All of a sudden, they weren't allowed into Jerusalem. So what could they do? So many of them lived, right, in the valley, in the Jordan Valley, Beit Shan area. So they would come from the Jordan Valley, right, from the east, and the closest place that they could get to Jerusalem where they could actually see the Temple Mount was the Mount of Olives. Now I can tell you this, and if you listen to this on a tape, it sounds interesting, but when you're standing up here on the roof, you see what I mean. You know? You can see that's where they used to gather. Thousands and eventually tens of thousands of Jews would come there and celebrate the festival, and it must have been a very mixed celebration. On the one hand, you know, they could see the ruins of the temple. So can you imagine that you get to celebrate your festival here, overlooking the Temple Mount? We're still celebrating the ruins of the temple. At least they could see the ruins. We can't see the ruins, right? But, they couldn't come in. And eventually this became a holy place, because that was where the Jews gathered to dream and to yearn. And so eventually people wanted to be buried there. And that's how that became a holy place, and a burial site. And all sorts of legends about when Mashiach comes, you know, the dead will rise, they'll start there, whatever it might be. I find it amazing that I'm showing you the Mount of Olives, the place where Jews yearned to come home to Jerusalem, where their prayers mingled and went up to heaven together, one day will be allowed back into the Old City of Jerusalem. And I'm telling you this from inside the Old City of Yerushalayim, in a modern state of Israel, where that ancient vernacular of Hebrew has become a modern language. I mean, the most amazing thing is you could go back 1,800 years, you could meet those people on that hilltop who are your cousins, and you could talk to them, because we speak the same language. My children could speak to them. Right? And I'll tell you just one last story, and then I'll take any questions you have, right? One last story, just to fulfill the vista, okay? So you look up on the hilltop over there, you'll see there's an antenna behind the tree. Don't worry if you don't see it. That hill in the distance is called Armon HaNatziv. In 1917, when the British came here, they established that as the seat of power. That was the palace of the High Commissioner, okay? It's interesting that the Christians call that, they associate that as the Hill of Evil Council. You can imagine some of that thing, some of us may think that was appropriate at the time. But in any event, in 1948, when the British left and the State of Israel was declared, so the Jordanian Legion took that position. It eventually became a UN position. And Israel desperately tried to conquer that position for obvious reasons, because that's a strategic overlook on the Western City and on the Old City. We failed. In 1967, for the same reasons I described before, they decided they had to take that hill. There were actually 6-inch guns up there shelling Western Jerusalem. But they knew from their experience in Ammunition Hill that they could not take that hill from the front. So this time they got smart. And they dropped paratroopers by helicopter deep into the desert towards the Jordan Valley. These paratroopers came up in the middle of the night, Chativat Yerushalayim, I think, but I might be wrong here, right? Came up in the middle of the night, through that valley that you can see very clearly, up the village of Abu Tor, up the back of the hill. The Jordanians never expected the Israelis to attack from behind their own lines. And so they didn't fortify that side of the hill, and they were able to take that hill, and that's how they took Amon HaNatziv. Now, what I find most amazing about that is that 3,000 years ago, when King David brought his men to conquer the original city of Jerusalem, the original city of David was not here, where we're standing. It was down there in that valley. That, by the way, is an incredible thing to do. We're not going to have time to do this. I cannot urge you enough to find a way to get down there and take a tour of the city of David. It's incredible.
I think we're actually doing it Friday.
Oh, okay. So that's amazing.
This Friday.
They have actually discovered the palace. More and more archaeologists are coming around to the fact that they probably have found the palace of King David. Certainly the palace of kings. They found all sorts of remnants and archaeological evidence to suggest that they found a piece of a seal with the name of a scribe mentioned in the book of Jeremiah, Yirmiyahu, somebody who was the scribe of the king, exactly in that spot, etc., etc. In any event, King David came from the desert. We know that he was hiding from King Saul in En Gedi, where we're going to be, and down by the Dead Sea, which is directly in that direction. If you look at the topographical map of Jerusalem, unless mountains have shifted in the last 3,000 years, there is no other valley that King David would have come through to conquer ancient Shalem, ancient Jerusalem, but that valley. So 30 years ago in 1967, Israeli paratroopers are walking through a valley in the middle of the night to bring the Jewish people back home, and they're walking in the exact same footsteps that King David and his men walked 3,000 years ago to begin our journey in this home in the first place. And that, to me, is Jewish history in a nutshell. Jewish history is not a line. It's a circle. And we're just back in that circle, you know? And I guess the challenge is going to be how much we tap into what that circle is, okay? So we could stand up here, trust me, we once had a paraplegic, and he couldn't really walk with us on a tour, so we did a 3-hour tour. I brought up some chairs, we sat here, and we did a tour. We could do that, but why there's so many cats in the old city? Thanks. It's interesting, when the Turks came here, this is now a few hundred years ago, they discovered that this country was just rampant with mice. And rodents were everywhere. They got into their food supplies, they got into everything. So they did the logical thing. What do? They introduced cats. And they solved their mice problem, but now they have a cat problem. So there was some talk of introducing more dogs, and someone said, no, not a good idea. Anyway, just a quick thing. This mulberry tree, by the way, just as an aside, it's a longer story than we have time for. There was a Christian who was very into mulberry. You ever hear like round around the mulberry bush?
Yes.
Mulberry trees were part of an ancient pagan ritual that sort of snuck their way into Christianity and became part of certain traditions, especially in the Greek Orthodox Church. And he was really into mulberry trees. There's some merit for the soul in Christianity, in Greek Orthodoxy. And so he planted 10,000 mulberry trees around Jerusalem. And this is one of them. This is like a 200-year-old tree. Unfortunately, we're in the season where you can actually make jam by walking around the courtyard. So, but that isn't why I stopped you here. I mean, this is the most beautiful thing in this courtyard. You know, and when it's a hot day, you really appreciate it. You know, it needs a little bit of a haircut right now. But having said that, more than any place else I can think of, this represents to me one of the challenges that we have in life. You know, we spend so much time trying to get there, that we very often don't take the time to appreciate where we already are. You know? I mean, you meet people, and they're going to Israel, they're on the plane, and you know, they say, oh, so where are you going? That's the question. And that's an important question. You want to know where you're going in life. But don't forget to appreciate where you already are. Like, you're on a plane to Israel. That's unbelievable. Right? And the Old City is a classic example of this. Because what happens is, you know, you pass by pieces of history that here are all over the place. You know, you look, for example, over there, you're looking at a portion cut off from a pillar, you know, that's about 1,700 years old. You look over here, okay, and it's kind of hidden behind this table now, but if you come over here, you'll see what I mean. Underneath the bushes here, do you see this? That's a pillar that dates back to the Roman period. Okay? I once had an archaeologist on one of these tours. This is 1,800 years old. Anywhere else in the world, this would be in a museum. Here, it's like lying by the roadside. You know? I once actually saw... By the way, do you see this beautiful Roman architecture? See this? Well, you can ignore this. Because this is from an army ceremony. But in any event, there's a millstone that sits in the other end of the Horva Square. And I was once watching some kids eating in a restaurant, a schnitzel place, and they thought it was a garbage can. They threw their Coke cans in it. 2,500-year-old garbage can, right? Only in the old city of Jerusalem. Now, what fascinates me the most about this, and this is very interesting, you know, this pillar was built after the Hadrianic persecutions. It was probably part of a temple to Jupiter up on the Temple Mount. How it rolled down here over 1,800 years is an interesting question. It was almost certainly built by Jewish slaves, because that's who did their building. And that means that this pillar was built by our ancestor. When I say this, right, so you have to understand what I mean by this. You know, we say these lines like your ancestors roamed these walls. I don't just mean in generality that we're somehow related to this. And I'll give you an example by way of a statistic. I'll give you a statistic which is statistically incorrect. And I know it's statistically incorrect, but I'll give it to you anyway for purpose of example, all right? Imagine that every couple that got married had 5 children, okay? That's statistically incorrect, although in this neighborhood it's probably true. But imagine that every couple had 5 children, right? So now 2 people get married, and after 1 generation, they have 5 children. After 2 generations, they have 25 children. After 3 generations, they have 125 children, and then they have 625 children, and 3,000 will round it off children, and 15,000, and 75,000, and 375,000, 1.2 million, 6 million people in 10 generations, okay? 6 million people in 10 generations. Now, granted, not everybody who gets married has 5 children, and people marry cousins that are distant cousins in the gene pool, so they're repeating the numbers. So you know what? Add a generation. 6 million becomes 30 million. Becomes 150 million. Now, and that's 12 generations. If most people have their children by the time they're 40, that means that in 500 years, you've got 150 million people. Now imagine that a couple got married 2,000 years ago. How many millions, how many hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of millions of people should come from that couple? See, this worked in China, right? There are only 13 million Jews in the world. So first of all, it gives you a perspective of just what we've been through in the last 2,000 years. But it also makes you realize, statistically speaking, the probability, the possibility, that the particular Jewish slave who worked on this pillar, underneath the whip of a Roman centurion, that this Jew was not absolutely in your family tree, is so remote a possibility as to be almost infinitesimal. In other words, if you had a family tree that you could trace to every Jew, that every ancestor, your grandparents, great-grandparents, great-great-parents, right? You know, you have 2 parents, 4 grandparents, 8 great-grandparents, 16 great-great-grandparents. So this guy was in that tree. So this is your direct ancestor who's working on this pillar. You know? So if you could go back the Ackerman tree and find, you know, Shlomo David Ackerman, who didn't yet know that he would be an Ackerman, who was working on this pillar underneath the whip of a Roman soldier, and you could whisper in his ear that one day, 1,800 years later, his descendants would be standing here in a modern state of Israel, and where is Rome? He would tell you, you're nuts, because that was the greatest empire on the face of the earth. It'd be like me telling you, you know, that, I don't know, that Mexico is going to rule the world one day and America is going to disappear. You'd laugh. But here we are. You know, and that's also Jewish history in a nutshell. So the challenge while we walk around, and in general for the rest of the week, is to try to tap into all the things you see, what they are, where they are, you know, stop, notice, be, and don't just be going. Okay? Come. Follow me. All right, so just a brief word, because we're standing here. First of all, just as an aside, this is actually this was built by the Crusaders, okay? These arches were built actually by first and later robust by the second Crusaders. The Crusades were not a simple period of time for the Jewish people. You know, it has a romantic sound to it, right? You know, off for king and country to fight the heathen and defend the Holy Land. But if you were a Jew living in the time of the Crusades, that was not a simple story. Because how do you motivate men, vassals, serfs, men at arms, to follow a ruler off to walk
sometimes as much as 2,000 miles, perhaps never to return, at best to come back 15 years later and leave everything they know behind. You basically promise them everything they want along the way, right? And more often than not, that everything they want came at the expense of the Jewish people. Just as a point of interest, if you look straight ahead beyond where that green door is, that's actually the entrance to what's called St. Mary's Hospice. And that building is really the structure. In fact, you can see Israelite's roof, right? That's part of the structure that was the building of Israelite. In fact, underneath Israelite, there are absolutely Crusader excavations that we don't really want to dig up because then our property will get declared a historical landmark, so I'll deny it if I ever said it. But in any event, I got a little curious. You know, I mean, basically the floor of our Beit Midrash, where we study, was built by the Crusaders. So who were these people who came to the Holy Land and built this building so that one day we could learn Torah, right? So I did a little research. It was not hard to find. The first group of them were Teutonic Knights. They came out of the Rhineland in the First and later the Second Crusades. I know of at least 7 communities, and possibly now 8, that were completely wiped out by these Crusaders, right? And the most famous amongst them is Frankfurt am Main, okay? And the Jews of Frankfurt am Main, there's actually a special kina, a special song of lament, of mourning, that you say on the 9th of Av, which on occasion I've taught on Tisha B'Av here, that was written for this particular community. And what's interesting about this is that, imagine that you're living in Frankfurt am Main in the Middle Ages, right? So what do you do when you hear the Crusaders are coming? I mean, by this time, 1099 and later in 1153, you know what that means. I mean, they've already been through France. So you know that you're in big trouble. But what do? Well, you can fight, but who fought? I mean, Jews didn't know how to fight back then. You could run, but where would you run to? So you'd be in the next, you pick up everything, they're coming tomorrow. I mean, where would you run to? They'd just find you in the next community. It wasn't like there was a state of Israel back then. You could try to hide. They actually tried to take refuge in the castle of the local bishop, but they were refused entry for obvious reasons. So what was left to do? You can't run, can't fight, can't hide, certainly can't surrender. To pray. That was all that was left. And if you were going to pray in 1099 in medieval Europe, you wanted to pray together. So you went to the synagogue. And the synagogue was made of wood. See, the Nazis did not invent the wheel. They just learned their history well. So the Jews entered the synagogue, and they were davening, they were praying, and the Crusaders rode into town, and they surrounded the shul, and they set it on fire. And there went the community, the Jewish community of Frankfurt am Main. And those Crusaders came here, and they built a kingdom in Israel for 100 years. They actually butchered all the residents of the old city when they got here. By the way, Muslims and Jews alike. This city, the old city became almost Judenrein. Judenrein, bereft of Jews. And they built, among other things, this hospice, St. Mary's Hospice. That area underneath our dining room is where they used to eat. And what you can see outside of our Beit Midrash window is where they used to pray. And outside here is where they used to gather their horses. And this building we're standing under, this was a bazaar where they sold all sorts of goods, etc. And again, if you could go back 900 years, most of those Crusaders are buried, the ones who survived Salah ad-Din, are buried on Mount Zion, right? And if you could go back 900 years, and you could tell those Crusaders that they were building a building so that one day Benny Friedman and Martha Wolf could sit and learn Torah with you in the old city of Jerusalem, they'd say you were nuts. And here we are. I think they roll over in their graves every time I tell this story, right? The other thing that's worth mentioning, just because we're standing here, is this building behind us. I'm not going to take you in there, because you can do this on your own, but I highly urge you to do this. In fact, I feel bad for anybody who's listening to this tape, because they're going to chalas to do this. You're here. You're here all week. You can come down here on your break one day after lunch. It's a six-second walk, okay? And I'll tell you just the story of this place. You know, the burnt house, it's called. If you want to build an addition, you want to build a basement. So if you're in America and you want to build a basement, what do? You call an architect, you call an engineer, you call your wife, right? I mean, and you call a bank, right? In Israel, there's another guy you got to call. You got to call the antiquities department. You got to call an archaeologist. Because anywhere you dig in this country, you could find something. And if you're in an area that's designated an archaeological area, like the old city of Jerusalem, legally you cannot build here without consulting the antiquities department. So this family who lived here, they wanted basically, right? Hang on. Temavrim? Are you passing? Welcome to the Holy Land, to Israel. Okay. Wonderful to see you.
Where you are from? Nefatem. Huh? Ah, Nesiona, Buchim Abayim. Azaku Baruch. Well, you know, from the New York. From New York, from America. Queens. Zero, Queens. It's next to Kings, right? Okay. All right. Anyway, so, by the way, just realize there's a verse, a prophecy in Isaiah and Yeshayahu. Right? Amim Yavo, one day the nations will come from all over the world. You see these groups walking around here? I mean, this is like a 2,500-year-old dream, right? That's not noise. In any event, right? Right, it definitely includes Nes Ziona. In any event, so this family is building a basement, and they start digging down into their basement. And they start finding all this weird stuff. And they don't know quite what to do. And they dig down, and what they find is an archaeological ruins. They call in the antiquities department. And what they discover is the lower floor of a house, which has been preserved in its entirety. And when they explore and examine the floor of this house, they discover that this house has been burnt by fire. Okay? And they carbon date the fire, and the fire dates back exactly to the year 70. Alright? Because Josephus describes that at the end of the Great Revolt, when the Romans destroyed the temple, they set the entire area on fire. Okay, we're about to begin the month of Tammuz, which usually falls in July and August. And on the 17th day of Tammuz, right, 1930 years ago, in the year 70, the Romans finally broke through the walls, right, and they ended a 2.5-year siege. 3 weeks later is the Tisha B'Av, the 9th of Av, which is when they arrived at the Temple Mount and they destroyed the Beit HaMikdash and the second and the first, but whatever, right. You ever ask yourself, you know, everybody here pretty much walked in through the walls of the old city. And the Temple Mount's right over there. And the walls are over there. How long does it take to get from the old city walls to the Temple Mount? 10 minutes, right? 15 minutes if you're reading Rabbi Aaron's book. Right? 20 minutes if you just met the love of your life. Right? That's it. So, why did it take 3 weeks? In fact, these 3 weeks are called the 3 weeks of mourning, right? Because this was a terrible period for the Jewish people. The reason that these are called 3 weeks and it took them 3 weeks is the same question as the question of the Crusades. How do you promise Roman legionaries, men at arms, right, mercenaries, how do you convince them to stay outside of the old city walls for 2.5 years? You promise them basically everything they want. And more often than not, that everything they want came at the expense of the Jewish people, and this was no exception. When they broke through the walls, they raped, beat, pillaged, and burned their way through the old city. Josephus says there were 220,000 Jews living inside the walls of the old city of Jerusalem. 100,000 of them were killed in less than a month. 120,000 of them were sold into slavery. It flooded the slave market. Men who were wealthy from slave trade went bankrupt overnight. They had discovered a house that existed in the time of the destruction of the temple and that was burnt in that fire. And they started to explore what was in this house. They know that there were 5 people living in the house at the time. They know they must have been a wealthy family because they actually found food that remained, remnants of food, which during the siege and the starvation was unbelievable. They found a seal with the name Katros on it. Katros is a family name that's mentioned in the Mishnah, in the oral tradition, from 2,200 years ago. They were the family Katros that produced the Ketoret. The Ketoret was the incense that they burned on the temple. This was the home of that family that had the tradition to make the Ketoret. Right? They found a piece of a Roman spearhead lodged in what they think is a remnant of a piece of the door. They think that the only way that they could have found remnants of food is if they actually sort of were caught during dinner. They know, by the way, that one of these 5 people was a teenage girl, because they found the phone bill, right? But the real question is, what happened to this family? The theory is that Roman legionnaires burst in here while the family was sitting down to eat in hiding. What happened to the family? Were they killed? Were they led off into slavery? Were they separated? Did the parents have to watch while their daughter was dragged off? So you can go in here. You can watch a 20-minute slide presentation in English or in Hebrew. You just have to ask them. Pay your 10 shekels, very, very worthwhile. Okay? So realize as we walk that not only do you have to look at what you're seeing, but you have to think about what you're walking on top of.
Because we have no idea where we really are and where we're really walking.